I'm WFE President Joe O'Connor. There has never been a time when facts are more important to your health, your children's education, and to the democratic process. That's why I am particularly grateful to the more than 3,000 contributors who made our September On Air campaign such a success. Your investment ensures that WFAE and NPR will continue to deliver trusted context at a time when we need it most. Thank you.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. A letter to the New York Times in July 1936 asked, "Isn't it about time for the two leading presidential nominees to take advantage of the marvelous opportunity presented by radio to debate each other?" Nothing came of the idea. The gauntlet was really thrown down 4 years later in 1940 when a dark horse candidate, Wendell Willkie, challenged Franklin Roosevelt, who was seeking an unprecedented third term.
"I propose that during the next 2.5 months, the President and I appear on public platforms together in various parts of the country, and on those platforms to debate the fundamental issues of this campaign."
FDR's response? No thanks.
"I shall not have the time or the inclination to engage in purely political debate."
The country had to wait another 20 years before presidential nominees would agree to face off over the airwaves.
"The candidates need no introduction. The Republican candidate, Vice President Richard M. Nixon, and the Democratic candidate, Senator John F. Kennedy."
Nixon and Kennedy met 4 times during the 1960 race, but it's the first one, 60 years ago this past weekend, that history remembers, with Kennedy looking relaxed and Nixon sweating and sporting a 5 o'clock shadow.
"The question before us is, which point of view and which party do we want to lead the United States?"
"Mr. Nixon, would you like to comment on that statement?"
"I have no comment."
The debates were a smash with the television audience, but after 1960, debates went on a 16-year hiatus and didn't become required stop on the campaign trail until 1976, when another rite of passage began, the debates as seen through the lens of Saturday Night Live.
"Because this is the last of these historic debates, we will begin with our national anthem.
I can name that tune in 4 notes.
Sometimes the SNL caricatures are what we remember more than the actual debates. 60 years after candidates first appeared in our homes to make their case, Joe Biden and Donald Trump continue the tradition tomorrow with the first of 3 debates in the closing weeks of the 2020 race. But how pivotal will they be? Will anyone be swayed or just have their decision confirmed? On this Politics Monday, we talk with 2 experts on presidential debates and political communication. Alan Loudon is, to use his words, is the in the midst of retiring professor and former chair of the Department of Political Communication at Wake Forest University. Thank you for joining us.
You bet. Thanks, Mike.
And Dr. Mitchell McKinney is professor of communication at the University of Missouri and director of that university's Political Communication Institute. He recently co-wrote an article titled "Why America Needs Presidential Debates Now More Than Ever." Thank you for joining us, too. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike.
Morning. So let me start with you, Alan Loudon. The so-called presidential debates are not debates. In fact, they are quasi-interviews in which respondents are asked a series of questions for which they have 60 to 90 seconds to formulate a response to what is usually a very complicated issue and have to encapsulate it into a soundbite. And also keep the dynamics of the race and the dynamics of the debate itself in mind as they answer those questions. Why? Why do we do it this way? And wouldn't it be better if we had a legitimate debate between candidates?
Maybe. I don't know how you have a legitimate debate in a milieu of the campaign, because there's so much going on in a campaign. These people are debating, if you will, with each other. with particular segments of the audience. They're debating with the national narrative. They're debating with all kinds of things, as you indicate. It's a complex process. And I did debate as a debate team. We won a couple national tournaments. It was pretty cool, and we did that for years in a real debate. I don't know, I'm not sure what that would produce. It might produce in this particular debate a narrative that says one of them doesn't know what they're talking about and the other one can't talk. Those might be the kind of things that would come out of a regular debate, but I'm not sure what happens in this debate.
But would that not serve us? Would we not learn something more about the candidates or about their stands on issues?
We're not going to learn anything more than 90 seconds. They're not going to learn more than they want us to learn. And, of course, there's this notion that debates are kind of an unfettered moment. We actually get to see these people in a real situation. They're not totally abnormal. You have to indicate, you have to interact in real life as a president as well. You have to also stand up there and entertain and cajole and persuade as a president. I don't know that they're entirely different in that sense. So I think the term debate may be a misnomer, but a conversation isn't much closer.
So, Mitchell McKinney, you have served in the past as a consultant to C-SPAN and the U.S. Commission on Presidential Debates, which run these debates, giving advice on how they might be structured to better educate voters. And I'm not sure when you did that, but when you were on that commission, was your advice taken? And is what we have been witnessing over the years part of that advice?
Well, actually, working with a team back in 1992, when we were advising regarding the establishment of the town hall presidential debate, and so that advice it was incorporated. We started the town hall. The commission instituted the town hall debate. This is where the undecided citizens are gathered from the community in which the town hall debate is taking place, and they. Put questions to the candidates. And so that was the extent of my involvement. And I do think what we found in terms of the debate's usefulness. Now, again, you know, do we call it, as Alan said, well, maybe a misnomer? What do we call it? Do we call it an encounter between the candidates? Citizens, and then we could talk too about the usefulness of that town hall debate. But citizens point to debate as a trusted moment, most useful in terms of when we ask them what campaign information do you trust? We see this, I think, reflected in the continued viewership. Unlike the party conventions, unlike most everything surrounding politics today, where there is waning interest, not so in the presidential debates. We set records 4 years ago, over 80 million for that first debate. And I think much of that is driven by the fact that viewers of the debate believe that they're getting the real, the true, the authentic candidate. And what I think they mean by that when they say that they trust the debate as a source of information is that the candidate is there without teleprompter, without notes, without their aides surrounding them. They're in the moment, as Alan suggested. They don't know the questions that are going to be put to them. Now, we may hear rehearsed lines, but viewers and voters are able to discern, they're just repeating, or how do they interact with one another, or when they are forced or there's a follow-up by a journalist, they're challenged either by their opponent. How do they respond in that moment? So I think that those are the benefits. True debate, not true debate. I go back to one of the vice presidential debates that we had with Al Gore, Admiral Stockdale, and Quayle. The commission that year decided that they were going to take off some of the limits and let the candidates so-called debate one another without structure. It was a flop. The candidates were not willing to even shut up and listen to one another. They wanted to filibuster the time, if you will. So we can try to force the candidates to debate, but if they don't want to. So in the end of the day, I do think the voters find this moment a useful moment.
So go ahead, Alan, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask Mitchell a question because when they did the town hall debates with Clinton, I understand Clinton would be on board on that. Why did George Bush ever accede to that requirement of having a town hall debate?
You know, Alan, the dynamics of the race, as we know, really dictate a lot. We started with FDR refusing to debate. Quite often, incumbent presidents, that we know, they don't like to debate. They don't like to give that time and attention to their opponent. Mm-hmm. Unless we're in a race where the dynamics are such that an incumbent president is trailing, that an incumbent president is seen as, okay, I've got, I'm forced into this. Now, in some ways, you're right. It was Bill Clinton who quickly accepted and wanted to do the town hall debate in 92. I think, and we saw some of this as in the candidates walk through before. We saw some of this on the stage that night with George Bush checking his watch. In some ways, I don't think that he knew what he was getting into. And fully appreciated. Again, that was an innovation that was new in terms of how are we going to do this, and we're going to sit here on these stools, and we're going to walk around, and we're going to interact with the public. And then we saw that was Clinton's strength, but not George H.W. Bush's, feeling somewhat out of place, awkward, and at times clear he wanted to get out of there.
Is there a price to pay? I mean, these debates have been going on now every 4 years since the 70s, but there was a long fallow period, and they didn't start really in earnest till the 1960s. Is there a price to pay today if a candidate would say, no, I'm going to pass. I'm not going to do these debates?
I think definitely they're almost forced into it. What surprises me in the current atmosphere that the Presidential Commission still has charge of the debates, it could be they're just such a hot potato that the networks don't really want to take that on, and they're happy just promoting themselves through the primary debates. But yeah, if they were to say no and the other person says you better do it, the bad press there might rival your tax returns.
And I know that, Alan, you have insisted that we learn something from these debates, tomorrow night's debate will probably be the most watched television debate, certainly of this series, possibly ever, because of the partisan nature of the country at the moment and because of these two candidates. Are most people going to be watching because they hope to learn something, they want to learn something, they haven't decided yet? Or are they going to watch because they just like the fireworks? They just want to see which man is left standing when it's done.
Of course, how contested the race is has a lot to do with the viewership. And Mitchell's right that we have this huge turnout last time with Hillary and Trump, particularly on the first debate, because it's great sport. Are most people watching? Maybe they're watching to see the other person screw up so they can get a political advantage. It's more like watching. The reason for the uncertainty adds to this pool of people coming to it. And I would say the viewership is probably more correspondent with like an NFL football game than it is, I want to learn things about the campaign. Everybody is fairly well informed. They know a lot of things, but we want to see them interact. And part of our judgment there, we'll come back to that maybe later, our judgment isn't just about did I learn about the issues or did I learn if the person has character. I learned about them because of how they interacted.
So I have about a minute left, Mitchell. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says that Joe Biden should not debate Donald Trump. Her reason is her assertion that the president has no fidelity to fact or truth and lacks fidelity to the Constitution of the United States. Why bother, she says, he doesn't tell the truth. All of that's a quote. And that's true. Almost every statement out of his mouth is some form of a falsehood. So how do you debate someone, and what is going to be gained by doing so? How do you do that under those circumstances?
Well, I think it is a tall order for Joe Biden, and in many ways, as I've thought through this, analyzed, there may be much more for him to lose in this debate than Donald Trump. And it's because of that sort of inoculation that we have come to ascribe to the president of no matter what comes out of his mouth, no matter what hyperbolic claim, no matter what taunt, what many other candidates could do and it would redound negatively toward them, not so Donald Trump. But for Joe Biden, a gaffe, a blunder, I think really could set him back. So I think that may be what the speaker's suggesting.
Well, Chris on Facebook writes, Trump will roast Biden. We'll leave it at that. We'll come back with more in a moment. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fifth Third Bank, dedicated to the financial empowerment of the community by investing time, resources, and people in the Charlotte area and throughout the state. More at 53.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about presidential debates in the abstract and tomorrow's debate in particular between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. Alan Loudon is with us. He's a former chair of the and a professor of communication and a former chair of the department at Wake Forest University. Mitchell McKinney is professor of political communication and the director of the Political Communication Institute at the University of Missouri. Mitchell McKinney was just talking about how you deal with a candidate who has trouble with the truth, Alan, and some have said that Biden should fact-check the president, which would be a task that would consume the entire debate, one would imagine. Others have said he should ignore that aspect of this debate and take a different tack. One columnist advises Biden to preempt Trump, remind the audience, he said, that, and Trump himself, of what undoubtedly will be coming up that evening in terms of name-calling and grievance, and to let the president and viewers know that we're on to him, saying, quote, "Everyone knows that whatever you call fake is real. Whatever you call a lie is the truth. Whatever you accuse others of doing is what you've done." A reversal, he says, of Trump's "everyone saying it" device. Is that a good strategy? What would your strategy be?
Maybe rather than calling him President Trump, Biden might refer to him as President Hoax, since that seems to be his favorite word, which would lead in, of course, to the tax question with the New York Times. My guess is he's going to do some form of, as he has in other debates, some form of "there you go again" in a very subtle way, and he's going to just basically stick to his argument. Let Trump do something silly. Now, Trump, you see, could be, I would go after what he knows about an issue, because the sort of narrative out there is that Trump has a lot of hoo-ha. Maybe some people interpret that as leadership, and he has guts to go with things, but he doesn't know what he's talking about. Rather than calling him a liar, because everybody does that, they're going to fact-check this thing to death during the debate, let alone afterwards, on all our social media, that he basically calls him on, "you don't know what you're talking about," and let that narrative define the debate. Is one possibility.
It is said, Dr. McKinney, that Donald Trump is not practicing for these debates, preferring to do what he's done to get him where he is today, and that is shoot from the hip. What would you tell Donald Trump about how to deal with Joe Biden?
Well, I don't think that that's a surprise that he's not practicing. He likely sees his many stump speeches, and he's taken to the stump again in his ostensibly those coronavirus daily briefings, and so that style that he brings to the podium of as you say, shoot from the lip, is likely what we'll see on the debate stage. And in terms of his treatment of Joe Biden, I fully expect, again, we typically see the president deliver in the same style, in the same manner that as he did 4 years ago with Hillary Clinton. Those were the most conflictual debates in the history of presidential debates in terms of attack oriented. And we even created and had to create a new category in our analysis, and that was taunting or name calling. Much of that was from Donald Trump directed toward Hillary Clinton. Now, she held her own in terms of pushing back. So I fully expect that that's the tenor that we'll see from Donald Trump directed toward Joe Biden. And then, as Alan said, then Biden's going to have to make some decisions in terms of how does he deflect? How does he respond? And perhaps with some, sort of homespun Biden chuckle or humor, and then just try to move on to keep his message, as Kamala Harris would say, on prosecuting the president's record.
And that's what
the debate is about.
Biden is rehearsing for this. How do they rehearse? How do you prepare for any debate, much less one in which one of the candidates is going to sling slings and arrows at you? Mitchell McKinney. Oh, go, Alan, well, go ahead if you want to.
go ahead. Either way.
I'll just speak to certainly what we know about past presidents, vice presidents who go through great, they remove themselves from the campaign trail for a number of days. They construct mock studios, debate stages. They have stand-ins that somehow would capture the demeanor, the tenor of their opponent. They go through the sessions. Now, quite often what we've learned too in through history, you know, we go back to Ronald Reagan and some of his debate performances that fell flat. Other candidates, they will have the voluminous briefing books, you know, and on that front, we can point to some of our research that we have that shows that the candidate that typically will stand there for 90 minutes and spewing the most facts and figures and statistics and evidence is seen by the viewing public as losing the debate. And so that tended, and perhaps the president has read that research, I doubt it, but perhaps that's his approach to not over-prepare for the debate.
Well, let me give you, if that's the case, if people perceive people spouting off facts and figures as being the loser of the debate, does that give Donald Trump the advantage?
They see him as a loser of the debate because they're not contextualizing in a bigger sense what this stuff means. Everybody's got facts. Even Trump has facts. They may or may not be real, but he has them. That is not, facts don't matter. It's what it means. What is the meaning of all this? And the one who can create a narrative about how all this fits together is in much better shape, I think. I'm curious about, you mentioned earlier, maybe I don't mean to get us off track here because this is kind of interesting. This notion of who, how they're going to address each other. And is Biden going to sort of, with a chuckle, I like that, ignore, there you go again, kind of chuckle. And or is, what happens when Trump calls him, he's probably not going to call him Sleepy Joe. That's going over the edge, and there's certain politeness and still some conventions here going operating, although not too many anymore. But when he calls him weak, is that he's going to probably do that. Does this give Biden a total opportunity? Is this almost a softball in a way? On the preparation, you can over-prep. But I have this philosophy in coaching people for debates is that nothing can come out of their mouth that's not in their head. And so their preparation does matter. So what we're going to hear from Trump are the Trump are the speeches he's been giving every night around the country. That's what we're going to hear, I think.
So Donald Trump honed his performance in the last presidential debate with Hillary Clinton through his rigorous performances in the primaries, where he castigated every single Republican opponent in ways we had never heard before. Likewise, similarly, Joe Biden has had a lot of experience this campaign season, debating the biggest roster of Democratic candidates in the history of the presidential primaries. So he's coming off of those. Donald Trump has had 4 years to relax and not have to do anything. If he takes the same approach he did with Hillary Clinton with Joe Biden, what would the impact be, Dr. Loudon?
Whoa. she won by most measures, and I try to critique these things as sort of a neutral party in terms of the presentations and the debates and their political impact. And I thought Clinton won all three of those debates. And it wasn't just because she was more informed, which she was, and it wasn't because she didn't fight back, which she did. So what happens in that? But her style is so much different. And she won the debates, but she didn't win the election. So these things have some importance, but only in terms of the larger context.
Well, she actually did win the election. And
she won 3 million more people in California. She didn't win the election.
Okay. Technicalities.
Well, you know, I mean, we hold these things with certain rules. That reinvention, I have marginal sympathy with. your question of what happens when he's, are you asking what happens when he's as aggressive with Biden as he was with Hillary?
Well, if he takes the same approach, because he's dipping into the old playbook on the stump with some of the same themes, and if he uses the same approach, dip into the old playbook for the debates, will it work better or worse on Biden?
I think it's going to be harder to do that on Biden because he has this sort of I'm a good guy. It's not fair, and people weren't too bothered when you attacked Hillary directly.
Okay. So in 2016, Donald Trump had nothing to lose and everything to gain. This time he has everything to lose. He is, after all, the president. 4 years ago, he rarely responded to barbs thrown at him by opponents in debates. And according to Philippe Rhines, who studied Trump in order to play him in debate rehearsals with Hillary Clinton, his basic approach, Trump's basic approach was, I'm great, you're terrible, and then off he'd go onto a tangent that had usually nothing to do with the question he was asked. Would a similar approach work this time, Mitchell McKinney?
Well, I think, and you've hit upon it, Alan has suggested too, what we are likely to see from the president is the approach that he has taken now over and over and over. And so then I think this puts the onus on Joe Biden of how does he address, how does he respond? And I think this notion of the likely aggression and attack, again, Trump has he would continue what he did 4 years ago, and then for Joe Biden, I sense there, particularly with, as we said earlier, most folks show up to this debate to root on their candidate and to be energized and then to mobilize, and that's what happens in terms of, you know, there's few minds changed. I think there's some desire to see a strong Biden, particularly as Democrats and the base, Biden's base, you know, they've become concerned with what they regard as a dangerous president. And so, you know, Biden at times has said, you know, I'm almost about to lose my temper, or he's almost about to get me riled up. I think there's going to be a desire, as I say, to see an aggressive Biden show up and deal with this, what many perceive as a bully, and not be overshadowed. If there is, in the president's words, a low energy Joe, I think Biden runs that risk of feeding into the president's narrative that perhaps Biden is just not up for this. So then on the other side of the stage, Trump can just be Trump, and that's what we all expect.
Yeah.
So the work in these debates, I really see a greater onus on Joe Biden in dealing with Trump in these debates.
Trump has called, as you mentioned, he's called Biden any number of names, and he's attacked his energy level, his age, which is ironic given the age of the president, his stamina. In truth, Biden has a stammer, which he has had to contend with his whole life, and sometimes he makes gaffes when he talks. Both things have become part of the narrative about Joe Biden. The president has also painted all Democrats with the socialist brush and the idea that under Democratic control, the world as we know it will be thrown into anarchy. Meanwhile, Democrats point to the coronavirus pandemic and say that Trump's handling of it has been the worst example of presidential leadership in the history of the country. And Alan, you have said for a debate to make a difference in a race's outcome, it needs to unequivocally deny the existing media narrative or voters' views of the candidate in a way that solidifies or changes the race. We have two strong narratives about these two candidates right now. How do you do that? How do you change the narrative for either man?
Well, if the narrative that Biden is not wanting to confirm. Now, you can say, this cuts both ways. You can endorse a narrative as well. You can prove that it probably is true. You know, that's that Dukakis is a technocratic president or something. You can endorse a narrative just as much as you can contravene one. Joe Biden's fitness for office is a sleeper in this campaign that Trump is feeding daily through his social media political ads in various ways. And so if that is confirmed, that he really is kind of out of it, sort of a pre-Reagan second term way, then I think that could be decisive. If he comes out and he fights back and he gets mad a little bit in a legitimate way and isn't weak in that sense, and then Trump doesn't know what to do when somebody stands up to the bully, then that would be really confirming for our sense of who Trump really is kind of notion. But that's so risky when you're up in most states. Why would you risk taking that moment? That moment could decide the presidency in terms of dealing with the Trump narrative of what he really is. It's just, you know, it's just braggadocio. It's not really there. But that is risky as heck. I don't know. I don't Mitchell, I don't know. Do you think? I think he doesn't do that.
Well, I think, you know, the dynamics of this race. I mean, there is a slight national lead for Biden, and then you drill down to those battleground states, and
trickier.
There may be a slight lead, but when you're talking about a 1 or 2 or 3 point lead, that I don't think one could really rely on that. And so, yes, there are risks. Just as there are risks for Biden to, as you say, feed into that narrative that he's not up for this, then I think, or commit a gaffe or a blunder, or to not mobilize his base and to energize Democratic supporters by seeing him standing up to the president. So you're right, exactly. This is high stakes. And as we do this kind of analysis, you know, my ledger comes down more on the side of Joe Biden has some important work to do, whereas we again turn to the other side of the stage and we expect the president to be the president and to do his bullying and taunting and hyperbolic claims. And when he makes claims that have no basis in fact or reality, we tend to now shrug it off and move on. And so he's really created, as I've said, in some ways kind of inoculated us against really a critique of his performance. And I fully expect that that's what he's going to turn in.
I have this sense that debates often make a lot of difference, not always in changing people's minds, but confirming what they already believe, which is political too, and it also has impact. This time around, I'm thinking, man, this debate could really be important. No, it won't be, because we're going to trump it with a dozen other issues in it after the debate and throughout this whole process, and Trump's going to change the focus point of talk so much that the debates have no chance in competing in this menu of issues and craziness and all that. And so in some ways the debates could happen and be important for a two time cycle and then go away because something else is taking over. The debates aren't quite the same thing in relationship to a campaign which has unfettered and no rules.
Kevin on Facebook writes, over the years of presidential debates, can your guests point to one or two that were actually very significant for the campaign or the outcome of the election? And you've already mentioned one moment, the moment in which Ronald Reagan said, "There you go again." That was a memorable moment, and I think it may have played a big role in his election. Can you think of others?
Oh, there's scores of others, since we're talking to people in North Carolina, let's talk about North Carolina debates, that have two of which happened at Wake Forest, right?
30 seconds.
And you get, there you go again, your card-carrying ACLU member with Bush versus Dukakis, changed it. You get Gore, you are a different person in every debate, so we don't know who the hell you are. That cemented the narrative, which changed that race.
Alan Loudon, a professor of communication, political communication at Wake Forest University, with us along with Mitchell McKinney, professor of political communication at University of Missouri. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the presidential debates, first of which this series is tomorrow evening. Alan Loudon is here, former chair of the Department of Communication at Wake Forest University. Mitchell McKinney, professor of political communication at the University of Missouri. And Mitchell McKinney, the country is so politically divided. Voters, many of them, have already decided, and no matter what happens, it won't matter. In their minds, they won't change their opinion, and many of them have already voted, so they can't change their opinions. But you say that right now, in our polarized environment, these debates are more important than they ever were. Why?
Well, the argument I made in an op-ed in terms of we need debates, we need them now. I think, as we've seen, particularly during this era of the season of a pandemic, where, you know, much of our lives, not just our politics, has been upended, and there's great angst, there's fear, and wanting and needing to hear from our leaders. And there's been some criticism in terms of the president, in terms of there's no plan and there's no straight message. There's no no reliable information and news. And then, you know, we've seen in terms of our political campaigning, right? We're this is a consequential election that we're heading into. And we've seen less of our candidates now that the president has taken back to the stump recently. The conventions were at least mostly virtual and the viewership and the interest really waned. And so in that context, and that's why I fully expect there's going to be perhaps record viewership again in the first debate in this round of citizens really yearning for information to see and hear their leaders. And again, I think that will play into the discussion in terms of, you know, we've talked about the president and his style, his Joe Biden, and there I would turn to his empathetic style, his caring style. You know, will it play well on the stage with this aggressive, some say, bully? It might, I think, play well for Joe Biden. Particularly, we could talk too about the town hall debate, where there will be citizens present asking questions. That might be a strength for Joe Biden. We saw 4 years ago, Donald Trump was a little awkward in that town hall debate. Some said stalking the stage and following Hillary around and looking a bit out of place. So, you know, I'm looking ahead even to that debate as a pivotal moment in this debate series.
A couple of questions for you, Alan. The first one is that you have recommended, and you told CNN this, that candidates need to learn to keep their answers short. When you're dealing with such complex issues sometimes, that's got to be terribly difficult. Why is it important?
To make them short when, mm-hmm. when you're coaching people for debates, if you can get them to talk about an idea in 1 minute, and they have to actually get cogent, it really helps. It improves everything, their press conferences, it improves their other speeches and everything else. The fact that we can talk about things that have weight in a shorter period of time, we certainly can. Maybe that comes from my old debate background, but you can say a lot in a small amount of time if you say it well. And if they start doing that and get those kinds of answers in their heads, then I think they improve immensely.
The other thing that you say is that in these debates, authenticity is what trumps, no pun intended. Donald Trump may be incapable of stating anything other than alternative facts that conform to his worldview, but he is authentic. He is not presidential. He is norm-busting, but he says what he's thinking, and that comes from out of his being authentic, which is exactly what his supporters like about him, his authenticity. Is Biden equally authentic in his own way? And which version of authenticity will play best to the camera and the
board? Wow. Biden, when he did his thing with the child about stuttering, Biden, when he's with some voters and is empathetic to their situation, there is an authenticity. Biden, when he goes back and tries to capture that with a visit to Scranton or something, there is sort of a, you know, I'm a blue collar authenticity to him. When he takes the train home, there's an authenticity. How do those translate in a debate? I'm not sure. People do underestimate Trump's ability to do the authenticity thing. And here's how I think of that. Trump, sort of like Bill Clinton, is sort of the Wizard of Oz, and he shows you behind the curtain and shares with you this notion that that somehow, you know, I'm lying, you know what I'm doing, you know politically what's happening, let me share that with you in an authentic sense. And he also is self-deprecating. People miss that. And he also has humor. People miss that. All of which tout up to being authentic. Now, of course, we hate that authenticity for certain segments of the populace, but it's still there, and people tend to push it away.
Well, did Donald Trump's authenticity take a kick in the you-know-what yesterday when the New York Times revealed his financial situation?
We got this September. It takes a kick every week in the authenticity thing, in the truth sense, but that does not make him inauthentic. Mitchell, you take this and run.
I think the authentic Trump that is appealing to Well, a large segment of our citizenry, right? I mean, he did win the Electoral College and 2 or 3 million votes less than Hillary 4 years ago. Is that authentic, straight shooter or not politically correct? And you hear that a great deal, right? He's willing to say things and do things that the normal or traditional politician won't say or can't say. And now a lot of those things that are said, again, when we fact check them, but then those who see him as being authentic seem to not care. And maybe going to the very first thing that we heard from the president was fake news, again, attacking the source. And so those who see him as somehow, authentic, I think we'll buy into, okay, yes, he's told us, right? Don't believe. He likes to attack the news media, anyone that will call him into question. And therefore, those individuals who are supporting the president will accept that, will believe that. Hmm.
Because the Commission on Presidential Debates chooses the topics of each debate ahead of time and only releases those topics within a couple of days of the debate, is there any way you think, because you've been on these panels, Mitchell McKinney, that the moderator for the first debate, Chris Wallace, will be able to work questions about the New York Times blockbuster story yesterday about Donald Trump only paying $750 in taxes in 2016 and nothing at all in 10 of the last 15 years? Is there a way that Joe Biden should be working on how to shoehorn references to that into whatever question he is asked as a response?
Well, certainly Joe Biden can. We know quite often in these debates, candidates deviate, completely ignore the questions put to them, and will go off in areas that they wish to highlight. And also, so Chris Wallace, he announced the general topic areas that he's going to pursue, and I noticed that he left himself a lot of wiggle room in terms of some rather broad, their leadership or their record. And so within these broad categories, I would expect and hope that he will work in the latest news in terms of how it relates to the president's record, performance in office, statements that the president has made. And I hope on that front that we will see these journalists that have been given charge of the debates, that the moderators, that they will be willing to push back, to follow up with questions, as opposed to that they're simply there sort of as a timekeeper to throw out a topic and let the candidates say anything that they wish to.
Alan Loudon, Professor McKinney has said that the one moderator format is far superior to these multiple moderator formats that we've witnessed, particularly in the presidential primary debates, and all of the presidential debates will be one moderator, and those moderators seem to have a lot of control. I think, how much control? I know that the topics are set by the commission. How much control? They're not set by the commission, Mitchell?
No, the journalists are free. They came up, they developed the topics, and then the questions within the topics, no one, the commission does not know, the candidates are not, only the journalist, the moderator who's in charge of the debate knows the questions that will be asked of the candidates.
So some are worried, Alan Loudon, about Chris Wallace, because he's from Fox News, although among the Fox News people, he is known to be a pretty straight shooter and not terribly partisan. Meanwhile, President Trump has cast shade on Chris Wallace, saying, Chris is good, but I would be willing to bet that he won't ask Biden tough questions. He will ask tough questions of me, and it will be unfair. I have no doubt about it. He will be controlled by the radical left, end quote. Is the president engaging in what he always does by calling challenging questions unfair and in the process setting up low expectations for his own performance so that if he exceeds those expectations, he wins?
Of course, but all the candidates, and especially their campaigns, maybe more than the candidates, try to set expectations so you can exceed them or you have a low threshold. Wallace is an interesting pick. His statements on it says the really good moderator of a debate disappears and you forget who moderated it until afterwards, because they're the conduit letting the candidates actually say and hang themselves by their own noose, if you will, mm-hmm. in the debates and let them go. Wallace, I think, is not bad. He the last interview he did with Trump got Trump into a whole bunch of trouble, and Wallace pressed him on things that he was unable to answer, like several issues where Wallace just followed up and pressed him. And so I think that is just sort of the icing on the cake fol-de-rol before a debate, which tends to be trumped, if you will, in the debate or after the debate, and that narrative that follows is much more important. Wallace is just as likely to go after Trump as he is going after Biden.
So in this first debate, the topics will be, the six topics for which they are devoting 15 minutes per topic, will be the candidates' records, the Supreme Court, the coronavirus pandemic, race and violence in city election integrity, and the economy. And the Washington Post pointed out that critics are saying the title of one of those topics, Race and Violence in Our Cities, seems to echo President Trump's contentious characterization of the protests this summer that we witnessed, and gives a false sense of the issue. When you add that criticism to the fact that the questions will be asked and have been formulated and chosen by Chris Wallace from Fox News, does that give credence, Mitchell McKinney, to the Washington Post's concerns?
Well, certainly, and I think one can agree in terms of the framing of that issue and how then the questions might likely go. But, you know, in terms of candidates' prep, I would say as easy as pulling all of Chris Wallace's most recent interviews on his Sunday morning talk, and he's dealt with this issue with guests and how he puts questions to them and what to expect. And so, And then Biden's ability to reframe and to call out disparities in terms of, well, wait a minute, why are you calling this? And so again, Biden has that ability to do that type of reframing. And it will be interesting to see in terms of how Chris Wallace is even or not in his treatment of the two candidates, in terms of is he trying to find these sort of false equivalencies in their background or in their record to somehow even up? Is he willing to call out statements, misstatements by the candidates on the stage? When we went to the single moderator format, it gives great latitude, great, I think, responsibility for these single journalists to be in charge of the debate. So let's hope that they'll execute that well.
Mitchell McKinney, a professor of political communication and director of the Political Communication Institute at the University of Missouri, we have to let you go because you have another engagement pending moments from now. But thank you for joining us for the hour. I appreciate it. Alan Loudon stays with us. Tom on Facebook says, every time Trump says something unpresidential, Biden should say, now Donald. And then Mike on Facebook says, one thing that Biden must do that Clinton did not is to look at Trump. Her failure or reluctance to do that made her look arrogantly above it all and intimidated by him. Do you agree with that?
I think it made her look above it all, which I think was the point. They were trying to do that. I mean, this guy's a street fighter, and this is actual presidential campaign. Come on, I'm going to actually treat it as a presidential campaign. Now, not looking at him, that's gendered difficulty in terms of that debate versus this one. I don't recall Biden looking at his opponents very much in the debates against Sarah Palin and things. He just sort of looked at the camera straight up. I don't even recall him looking at his opponents much, except when Elizabeth Warren got in his face, right? He didn't have much choice in that debate. I don't know. What does that mean to stare the other person down? And that can be interpreted 100 different ways. I think that's kind of risky.
Incumbents generally have a tougher time than some of the challengers because they say they're too busy to prepare because they're busy being president. And we've seen incumbent presidents stumble on these opening debates. George H.W. Bush did, Barack Obama did. I suppose it could be argued that Vice President Nixon was the incumbent, so to speak, in the JFK race, and he stumbled. I'm just wondering, if President Trump stumbles, doesn't do well, will he participate in the next two?
Well, you know, it's not easier to get out of the next two than it is to get out of the first one. I don't know. There is this sort of mythos coming out of the Romney Obama debate, that if you're the president, if you're not in practice. Visits to the states are in practice. Trump, Biden has done more debates. Who knows?
Do you see this having an impact on the election in one word or less?
Probably, unless something else happens bigger and say the tax issue blows up.
Dr. Alan Loudon from Wake Forest. Thank you. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.